What is cracking, Hope Nation? It is your friendly neighborhood, Kevin Hines. Ladies and gentlemen, family and friends, colleagues, and everybody else in between, today is a very special day. One, I've been waiting for. Today's incredible guest on the Hindsights podcast is the one and the only Emma White. Emma wears many hats in the suicide prevention and mental health space. She is an author, a professional speaker, a podcast host, and founder and president of the Life is Worth It organization. In her day job, she is the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Nevada Department of Education and the Project Aware Manager for the Office of Suicide Prevention. Emma's passionate voice and lived experience has gained national acclaim, most recently being selected as USA Today's Women of the Year Award for 2024. That's this year, folks. She gives back wherever and whenever she can. And if you are thinking of a new and incredible speaker for your event, look no further than Emma White. Emma, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the Hindsights podcast. How are you today?
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin. I'm so excited to be here. Incredible to speak with you as always. And so excited to dive into all the wonderful conversations we're going to have today.
This is going to be incredible. Your story is empowering. It's moving. It's impactful. It changes people's lives. So let's start, Emma, from the very beginning. Let's go back into the rearview mirror, into the time that you were born. Where were you born and what was your upbringing like?
I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada. I only lived there for about 4 years. We moved up to Reno, Nevada, which many people think is actually very close, but it's actually pretty far away. So it's about a 7-hour drive, different sides of the state. So we moved up to Reno for my dad's job when I was four. So I basically say I was born and raised in Reno, and I still live in Northern Nevada today, and I love it. It's wonderful. And I have two younger sisters. So I'm the oldest of those three. And my parents, and it's all of us living in Nevada right now. I've been fortunate that none of us have moved away or had to move away. So we're very close knit and probably see them more than I see anybody else.
That's awesome. So you're living in Nevada. You've lived there your whole life. Your family lives there. It's an incredibly close knit family. That's awesome. Let's really dive in here to what's been going on in your life. And what led you to doing the work you're doing today that we described in the intro? Can you share with us your journey of depression and suicidal ideation?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I don't think I ever thought was going to be my path in life. I never thought that I would have this journey or work in this field, but I'm so incredibly blessed that I am able to work in this field. And that's because I survived my own experience. So my experience started when I was 15 years old. I started getting bullied at school. I didn't know why. I've learned now it was because I had made the varsity basketball and varsity volleyball team as a sophomore. So I was the youngest on both of those teams. And I think sometimes when kids are younger, they act out in ways that they wouldn't act out maybe as they mature and get older. And so because I made those teams, I think there was maybe some jealousy there, or they just didn't know how to react to not making the teams themselves. And so started getting bullied in various forms. I started getting bullied in person, of course, at school. So I was thrown into my locker. People would throw things at me as I walked in the hallway to class, you know, like pencils and paper. I actually one time got home and I found gum in my hair, which was just crazy that I, first of all, was walking around with gum in my hair all day. So I didn't know that it was there. And then it just made me feel like, you know, people hated me for no reason. I also got cyberbullied. Now, if you think back, so it was 2010, I was 15, and our social media looked way different than it does now. So in 2010, we were still using Facebook. I think people were probably still using MySpace. I don't know if you were a MySpace, person. Yeah. And we just started getting some of those other platforms as I graduated high school. So we didn't really know what social media was going to do for people's mental health in general. And we definitely didn't have the tools on how to navigate it. So I started getting bullied on social media, which the funny thing about that is that I didn't even have social media accounts. I wasn't allowed to have social media, but I still was hurt by it because people would write things about me online and then I would go to school and people would show me. So it's an interesting thought that you actually don't even have to have a social media platform to be impacted by it. And then kids just being really cruel and spreading lots of rumors about me. And it was very hurtful and I didn't know how to deal with it. All of it happening at one time, it felt like, and it really did spiral pretty quickly. It was about 4 months from September to December of 2010 that I was experiencing all of these things. And I also started to get stalked. I had text messages that would detail every single thing about my day. So someone was following me around. They would tell me what I was wearing, who I was hanging out with, what I was doing. And they would tell me that everybody hated me, that I shouldn't live anymore, that the world would be better off without me. And I didn't know how to deal with all of those things. And so I started to just not think about my emotions, push them down as much as I could because I didn't want to seem weak and I didn't want to seem like I didn't know how to deal with these things, which is funny because when you're 15, how can you deal with those things? I don't think anybody would know how to deal with those things without life skills and life lessons to learn from it. So that led me to developing anxiety. Didn't really know that I was experiencing anxiety. I thought I was having a heart attack because we didn't learn about anxiety or depression or suicide in health class when I was in high school. And ultimately that led me to developing depression. Again, didn't know that I was experiencing depression. I just knew that I didn't feel the same and I didn't know who I could talk to about it. So ultimately after dealing with that for 4 months, that led me to planning to take my life on December 23rd, 2010. So 2 days before Christmas, and the pain had just become too much. I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't think that this pain could ever end. And thankfully my attempt was interrupted by my mom. So I'm incredibly thankful that I'm here today because I know had she not stepped into the room, I might not be here today. So I'm very thankful. And now it's my mission to help other people understand that that pain doesn't have to last forever and you can get through those things and we can do it together.
You've broken down, Emma, what you've gone through, what it led to, how you struggled, and you kind of walked into some of the lessons you've learned from this time in your life. Do you still struggle today with brain and mental health challenges?
I would say that I'm someone that's going to deal with depression off and on for the rest of my life. It's not something that I live with every day, but I like to call situational depressed sometimes. I know that's not a clinical term, but for me, there are things that will happen in my life that tend to compound on past things, which is why it's so important that I continue to go to therapy and work through those things, even 10 plus years out of it, because when things happen, sometimes it can put me right back in there. So I will say that I will live with depression for the rest of my life, but it comes and goes, and I've learned how to manage it. And I still struggle with anxiety. It's gotten a lot better. I've learned how to manage it, added some coping techniques and skills to my life to manage that anxiety, but it still happens and I'm okay with it. I've learned how to live with it and to thrive with it regardless.
Living with it, thriving with it, being a survivor and a thriver is so key and so crucial and such a, and your story can help educate other people as to how they can fight to do it too. What are the long-term impacts from being bullied in high school for so long?
That's a really good question. There are lifelong impacts. It definitely impacted my ability to form relationships with people, whether it was friendships or romantic relationships. And I think I struggled with trusting people for a little while because ultimately I found out that the people that were bullying me ended up being people that were friends of mine. So that was really hard because you were trusting people with your emotions and then you find out they were the ones that were actually causing that harm. So trust is a thing that I've had to work on and build. I think I've always had empathy for people, but when you go through those challenges, sometimes it's hard for you to find empathy. So that's something that I continue to work on. I think I'm empathetic by nature, but then sometimes you have to draw that line of, you know, putting boundaries for yourself and knowing when it's okay and when you need to walk away from things as well. So that definitely has impacted me from the bullying. And then I think confidence is something that we all have to work on our whole lives. Confidence doesn't come naturally for most of us, especially when you've been told that you're worthless, that you should kill yourself, that your life doesn't matter. So you have to continue to work on those things, you know, through your life, and recognize that oftentimes people say those things with no merit, and they say it because they were immature or they were hurting themselves and they didn't know how to process it. So those are the things I would say after bullying that I've dealt with, but I've come a long way with it. And I wouldn't say that bullying, I would say that I'm thankful for the opportunity in some ways, not that I would want to go through it again, but I'm thankful because it's taught me so much about myself.
That's incredible, Emma, that you've learned so much about yourself in the wake of what you went through. I was bullied heavily in grade school and high school because I was part Black, because of different reasons. But it was brutal, and it absolutely played a pivotal role in me leaping off the Golden Gate Bridge to try to take my life in the year 2000. So I feel where you're coming from. I have a question for you about, I want to know what your thoughts are on these social media moguls, these individuals who started and run and own these social media companies, and their outcries that say that social media doesn't affect young people's mental health, their absolute denial that it's having a terrible impact on their brains. What do you think?
Yeah, like I said, I think that people didn't realize what was going to happen when they created these social media sites. And things can be used for good or for bad, but we can see the research. We can see the data that's supporting that our people, teens, middle-aged adults, older adults, everybody is struggling in some way with the effects of social media and the technology world that we live in, because many people are on it all day long, especially when we see our younger kids. And it's not just our younger kids that are getting cyberbullied. We also see adults getting bullied on social media as well, but we see the impacts it has on their overall well-being. They compare themselves to photos that they're not even real, right? They've been edited a million times if they think that that's what that person just woke up and looked like. Maybe some of them do, but it's hard to see that when it's layered under lots of different filters. Or it's really easy for people to create fake accounts and to harass people online. So definitely we have to take accountability in what has happened with social media and do better and teach people what they can do to keep themselves safe online and how they should be treating people as well. So I think that it's definitely something we're seeing. We're seeing more and more conversations about it on a legislative side, on, you know, Congress and all different things. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that, because the impacts have been profound on people's mental health and overall wellness.
I think you got it. The impacts have been profound on their mental health and wellness. And like we talked about, look, we're right now in this moment, here we are, creating social media for good, right? This podcast, the clips that we later cut from this podcast, they will help people find that light at the end of the tunnel, that hope that's just around the corner. They haven't walked far enough to reach it. It will do good. And then hearing your story, Emma, and what you went through and how you overcame and how you live a good life today, thriving, as you said earlier, giving back to your community. I mean, you know, becoming USA Today's Woman of the Year, like, these are incredible accomplishments that you've achieved past your horrible experience in high school. So it's really just great to see. I have to be very clear about that. Emma, you started the Life is Worth It organization. Let us know all about it.
Yes. So like I said earlier, I never really thought or really didn't know what I could do with my experience. I just knew that I wanted to do something to help people, and I didn't know what that looked like. And in 2019, I started writing my book and organically just started this website called lifeisworthit.org, because I just wanted to provide resources to people. I wanted them to be able to find out information, because I didn't have that information. I didn't know where to go. We've gotten a lot better. I'm thankful for that. We are teaching kids about their health, their mental health. We've gotten a lot better. We're sharing resources broadly. I was watching a TV show the other day, and before the episode and after the episode, they gave a content warning about if you or someone you know is having thoughts of suicide, reach out to 988. So that was amazing. But I didn't have that. I didn't know that. So I wanted to provide that for people. So it started out with just a resource hub as a website, and then it organically moved into providing resources in the form of programs, workshops, and curriculum, our whole focus is to educate youth and their communities on what we like to call total life wellness. So total life wellness is the 8 dimensions of wellness from the CDC, and we've added unofficially a 9th dimension, which is digital wellness. So we provide a whole body, whole mind approach to what health looks like, because preventing suicide is complex. It typically involves multiple layers. So we can talk about mental health all day long, but we also need to incorporate physical health, what we're eating, how we're taking care of our bodies, who we're surrounding ourselves with, the decisions that we're making. So we do that in multiple forms, and we survived the pandemic, and I was really, really proud of that. And we're just moving forward, working with schools and nonprofit organizations and people that work with youth. So super excited about that, and just excited to see where it's going to go.
Emma, that is incredible. You are incredible. The work you're doing is phenomenal. How exciting to hear about that. Lifeisworthit.org?
Yes.
Friends watching, listening, viewing, subscribing right now, feel free to leave this podcast right now and go to that website and learn all that you can. Then come back later and finish the episode, no doubt. Okay, Emma, tell us the title of your podcast and what it's about.
Oh, yes. I just started a podcast. We took the second half of my book. So the book title is called It's Not Okay, But It Will Be. So the podcast is called the It Will Be podcast. And we really break down a lot of those things that I talked about with the organization. So passionate about total life wellness and taking care of our entire bodies and minds working together. So with the podcast, we're really breaking down a lot of conversations that people aren't always comfortable talking about, like toxic relationships, what it looks like to heal, what it means to forgive, and how it impacts not only the other person, but you internally. So we just started it a few weeks ago, and I'm really excited for this journey. It's just the next thing that we're using to help people to have those conversations.
It Will Be podcast. Found yes. Wherever podcasts are found, go check it out. Okay, Emma, what is something that you wish people knew about suicide survivors that you don't think is very commonly known?
There's a lot of things, I think, a lot of misconceptions when it comes to suicide. Again, we're getting better with it. I think stigma still exists regarding suicide a lot, but we're getting better, having more conversations about it. But I will say, when I started in this work, and I don't know, Kevin, if you've had this experience, I'd love to hear if you have, but when I started in this work, I think there were a lot of cliche statements that came at me. And I don't fault people. People have good intentions. A lot of times they don't know what to say, so they just say something that they think will, you know, fill that space for a moment. But I remember when I started in this work, someone came up to me and they said, "You don't look like you would survive suicide." And I kind of was like, what does that mean? I don't know. Or I've been told, you don't look like you would have someone, or you would be someone who had depression or have those thoughts of suicide. So I really want people to know that suicide impacts all people, all walks of life, all cultures, all demographics, all ages. Certainly there could be people at higher risk, but we never really know who is struggling. And likely you've probably been in a room with someone who survived suicide and they just haven't been able to share yet. So I want everybody to keep that in mind, that you never really know what people have been through and what they've survived. And instead of those cliche statements, maybe we can just say things like, "Thank you so much for telling me. I'm sure that was really hard to share." Because telling people that you survived suicide, it takes a little bit of time. It took me 10 years to be able to say that out loud. So I don't know if you've had the same experience, but it's something that I feel passionate about, educating people that you don't have to know what to say, but just provide empathy and support.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, Emma. Larry King, the CNN media mogul that he was, probably the greatest interviewer of all time, the original podcast host, if you will.
Yeah.
I met Larry King years ago before he passed. And when I met him for the first time, it was after we shot and filmed the movie, The Bridge, about the Golden Gate Bridge suicides. And I was in an interview in that movie with my father. And we were on Larry King's show, Larry King Tonight, I think is what it was called back then. And he said, "Kevin, you don't look bipolar, you know?" He said that, I'm not sure if it was before the show actually started or if it was actually during the episode, But he said, Kevin, you don't look bipolar. And it's so interesting because a person who lives with bipolar depression or a person who lives with schizophrenia, major depression, anxiety, all of the above, panic attacks, they can look like anyone. They can, can be the most put together looking person, or they can be the homeless person on the street who has nowhere to go and is talking to themselves out loud to the person they think is there that isn't. So we have to be aware of that and reduce the ideology that it's just that kind of person that would have that kind of thing going on. And you painted that clear picture right there. So it's really important. Emma, this is kind of the tough part of the conversation, I think. You have also lost people in your life to suicide. What is something you would say to suicide loss survivors who are listening, those who are missing right now their loved ones who are gone from death by their own hands?
Yeah, I want to say that I'm so sorry for anybody that's experienced that. It's a club that most people or nobody wants to be in, right? And that's something that survivors have told me. They said it's a club nobody wants to be in. And I feel that because you don't necessarily sign up for that club, but you are dealt to deal with all of the things afterwards. So first, I want to say I'm so sorry for people that are in that club and experiencing that. And secondly, I want people to know that they have to give themselves grace. I wasn't taught about suicide prevention growing up. And the only reason I know how to prevent it now is because I went through my own experience and then I got trained in it. So we have to give ourselves grace. If you've never been trained in CPR, it's really hard to expect somebody to immediately give CPR, right? So give yourself grace in that. But also, if there were signs, just give yourself grace. Recognize that people do make decisions even when we do our best that we can. So we want to help people as much as we can, but I just want to offer that support. Give yourself grace and then dive into how you can help other people moving forward. So maybe it's time to think about going to a suicide prevention training, or if you're not ready for a suicide prevention training, can you go to a support group so you can start feeling less alone in that? Because when you lose someone to suicide, you feel very alone. And a lot of times you feel like you're the only person in the world that's experiencing that. And I want you to know that you're not alone and there is amazing support out there for you. So that's what I would offer my insight on. Just know that you're not alone and there are people here to support you, and give yourself that grace.
Give yourself that grace. Know that you're not alone. Know that people do care and support groups do exist for folks like you who are going through such hurt and such pain. And there are books on the matter. If you look up suicide loss books on Amazon, you'll find a plethora of material that can help you find ways to grieve and get some peace of mind from what you are still going through. Look, let's be clear. Nothing we say here on this podcast is going to bring those people back. I have lost 18 people I care deeply about to suicide, to death from lethal emotional pain, as I call it. And it never gets easier. And I think about them every day, and their stories break my heart, but I don't hold guilt for those losses. Even though I used to think to myself, I wish I had called them. I wish I had reached out more. I wish I was there for them. Because I genuinely tried to get through to them when they were in pain. But I lost them anyway. And so I have to take that weight off of my shoulders, as we all do. It doesn't belong to us. They didn't die because of us or in spite of us. They died because of lethal emotional pain for whatever reason that had nothing to do with us. And so we have to recognize that and fight to find ways to move forward inside the pain of those kinds of losses. Emma, what are the things you do? You talked about the 8 dimensions of wellness on your website. What are the things you do to manage your mental health?
Yeah, I really try to find a balance in it. But as my therapist told me recently, what is balance? Sometimes we aren't able to balance all of the things, and that's okay. But for me, it's recognizing when I need to take space for myself, when I need to take time. I try to incorporate things every single day that help my overall wellness. So of course, the basic things like drinking water, getting sunlight, getting fresh air, looking away from my computer, because it's so easy to be on the screen for 8-9 hours every single day. single day. I start my day with meditation. So I might read or I stretch. I really love to sit in darkness and listen to relaxing music and do breathing exercises. That's really important for me, especially when I'm feeling anxious. That's something that I do. I walk my dog multiple times a day, one, because he needs it, and two, because I need it. So those things are really helpful for me, trying to eat as healthy as I can. But I also know when it's time to eat some dessert and indulge in those things as well. So those are some of the things that I do. And then really my support system is so crucial. So my friends and my family members, knowing who I can go to when I'm having those days of doubt or stress, or when the grief becomes unbearable sometimes. So those are the things that I do. There's a million things that I could be doing. I'm trying to be better about going to the gym and working out. So that's something I know, Kevin, you're really good about working out. So I need to get on that level, but I'm trying. So those are the things that I do to maintain that balance of wellness.
I love that. And those are great tips for anybody who happens to be physically capable to get to the ground, to get to work, to eat the anti-inflammatory foods that don't poison your brain, that feed your brains nutritionally and help your brain function at the highest capacity, to go to therapy, to meditate, to take time in the morning in silence, maybe in darkness, to listen to calming music and through soothing breathing exercises and techniques. There's so many great things that are proven to benefit your brain health that anyone with the ability to Google can find out about and learn about. If you go to our channel, youtube.com/Kevin Hines, 800 plus videos, all designed to benefit your brain health today. They're being used in health classes all over the world by health teachers every Friday. They're showing them to their students and then having them go and act out those mental health hacks or techniques, and then come back in a couple of weeks and tell us how they're feeling today. So there's a lot of resources out there. We have some of those for you. Emma, what advice would you give to someone who is worried about a loved one's brain and mental health?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. We definitely want to get that person help. And when we notice things are off, or they say something that makes our gut feel off, I say, go with your gut. If something doesn't seem right, it probably isn't. And you don't have to know anything 100% to help somebody. And you also don't have to be clinically trained or PhD trained to help save a life. It's amazing if you are, and we need those people as well, but being a kind, caring person really can help save a life. So if you've noticed something, they've said something seems off, don't be afraid to ask that question. The way we ask the question is really important. So our tone and timing is really going to impact their likelihood to be honest. So we want to ask without judgment, but we want to be open with them and say, hey, I've been worried about you. I've noticed something, or you've said this and it's making me concerned. You know, what's going on for you? Are you thinking about ending your life? I'm asking because I care. So I think don't be afraid to dive in to ask that question, because we really don't know how to help someone until we know what we're dealing with. So don't be afraid. And if they aren't thinking about suicide, then what else is going on for them? And I've asked that question a million times. I do get nervous still sometimes. So take a deep breath. You're not required to have all the answers, but you want to help and care for that person and get them connected to somebody who can help them. So I just encourage you to dive into it. Don't be afraid, and don't be scared. It's okay to ask the question. And oftentimes many people are waiting for you to ask the question.
Ask the three questions. Are you thinking of killing yourself? Have you made plans to take your life? And do you have the means? It could save a life. If we don't ask those questions to people we love who are showing signs of worry and we're fearing for their well-being, if we don't ask the questions, we will not know the answer. It doesn't put the thought in their mind if it's not already there. That is a myth. It gives them permission to speak on their pain. And as we all know, a pain shared is a pain halved. Sharing your pain with one person willing to empathize allows you to not feel so alone inside that pain. And for the people listening who love someone who's struggling with their mental health and they're worried about their well-being, you don't always have to have all the answers. My wife and I have this great tool, Margaret. She's my rock, my best friend, my light. And we have this thing. We say, fix it or feel it. When I talk to her, I need you to fix the problem, or I need you to feel the problem and be there for me to listen, to understand, not necessarily to respond. True active listening skills. are beneficial in the state of suicidal crisis, so you can get that person over the hump to the other side, to safety, and keep them here with you instead of attempting in the first place. Emma, how do you encourage people who aren't used to it to ask for help for their mental health and their brain health?
I really try to relate it to other health conditions. We're getting better at understanding that health is health, period. We try really hard to separate the two. We try to separate our physical and our mental or emotional health, but we really can't have one without the other. They really need both of each other. So an example is if you break your leg, yes, you are going to have to deal with breaking that leg, but there's probably going to be some other emotional side effects that come from that too. If you're really used to working out, you might not be able to work out anymore, which could impact your emotional health. So I think that I try to help people understand that this is all part of our health. And just as we go into the doctor to check for other things, physical health things, we go to check when our, you know, when our throat is sore, we go into the doctor. It's the same for our brain health. And I really want people to understand that, that both of our, you know, our bodies and minds, they're working together. Our mind is quite literally part of our body. So to say that we don't need to focus on our brain health is really just a deterrent to our overall health. So I really want people to understand that it doesn't make you weak if you need help for your brain, because we go and get help for our bodies all the time. So I really want people to understand that we all have brain health and we all have physical body health.
It's all just the same thing. I mean, First Lady Rosalynn Carter, I think 60, 70 years ago, was the first to say it. Mental health and health is just health. And, mm-hmm. and in 60 years, we haven't really, truly, as a society, we have not put those two together wholeheartedly as a culture and said, this is definitive. All mental health will be covered by insurance. All physical health will be looked at in conjunction with mental health. They are one and the same because they're physiologically connected to the two. Look at the issues of gut to brain health. Your gut microbiome houses and creates all of your body's and brain's serotonin and dopamine, affecting your mental well-being. If you're eating only processed foods, you're damaging your brain's functionality at the cellular level. So you have to really recognize that everything we do to our bodies affects our brain. Everything we take into our brains affects our bodies. I want to know, given the work you do in Nevada, what's currently being done right now in schools to prevent suicides that you're aware of?
There are a lot of things that are starting to come out, especially after COVID. Again, I think that COVID, the pandemic, was not a great time for most people, but things did come out of it that were more positive. People are more willing to talk about mental health. There's more funding coming through for these things. We needed it a long time ago, but we are now starting to see those things come through. So a lot of schools are expanding their social emotional learning. It is a requirement now. So they have to learn about their emotions and all of the things that go into that. And they're putting it into classes like math and science, because that impacts their ability to do their homework and to be successful with their homework and their work and the curriculum. So that's really exciting. I do manage the Project Aware grant under the state of Nevada. And Project Aware is a SAMHSA-funded grant that came out of the Sandy Hook shootings in 2012. So Project Aware stands for Advancing Wellness and Resiliency Education. So many schools in the United States have gotten this grant funding. It's a 5-year cycle, and it helps to build multi-tiered systems of support in our schools. So we're meeting the kids where they're at and helping them not only with their mental health, but the other needs that they have as well. Because we know that if someone is struggling with food insecurity, the likelihood of them coming to school or being efficient in their schoolwork decreases. So those multi-tiered systems of support are really important to build out. So lots of schools nationwide doing that. There's incredible programs that are being implemented, like Hope Squads, We do signs of suicide training for youth, do suicide screenings for youth. I do that all over the state of Nevada. I have the honor and I'm blessed to be able to help kids and ask them for the first time, are you having thoughts of suicide or have you ever? And I will tell you that there have been times when I've gone into schools and I've had a kid who survived suicide years ago and they've never told anybody and nobody knew. So I'm really grateful for those programs that are in our schools and we're just expanding it more and more. And then other things like a lot of our, well, in Nevada, at least, I don't know nationwide, but in Nevada, our student ID cards on the back of them, they all have the 988 number, which is incredible. I wish that I would have had that when I was in school, just to know that it was there, just to know that there was a resource. So those things are happening as well. And then more conversations about these things and not being afraid to ask and to talk about them. So we're seeing a lot of movement and I know that we need more, but we're seeing movement and I'm excited about it.
Emma, final two questions. What gives you hope every day?
That is a good question. I think for me, one is seeing how far we've come. And that does give me hope. People like you, Kevin, who have opened the door for people like me to be able to share my experience. And that might not have been possible without you being so open and honest. So I'm incredibly just blessed to meet people that have survived those challenges I'm just encouraged by how many people are being more open about these things because we all struggle at some point in our life. So I'm encouraged by that. I find hope in the sense that we are all here for a reason and there's no mistake in that. Somebody asked me, how do you find hope every single day, just like you did? And I just recognize that I'm here for a reason. I survived for a reason. I'm here to help people and I want to do all that I can. So that gives me hope in that just, and when you do have the opportunity to save someone's life indirectly or directly, it just lights a fire in you and you just want to keep doing it, you know, as much as you can. So I would say those things give me hope, willingness to talk about things, people being more open and people sharing and willing to accept that we all struggle at some point and it's okay to talk about those things.
Wow. I love hearing all of that. Absolutely incredible answer. Final question, Emma, if you had a magic wand in the realm of this brain and mental health space and suicide prevention and all the work you do, what would you use it for?
Well, I wish I could say I would ask for a million wishes, but I don't think that's how this one works. I would, if I had a magic wand, I would expand. Everybody would have access to mental health care. Everybody deserves to have that access to mental health care. And whether that's a therapist or group support or just expanded physical health services, whatever that looks like, as we talked about, it's health and everybody deserves to have that. So I would say that. And then part two, which I don't think I'm allowed to have a part two, but because it's a magic wand, I'm going to say this. I wish that we could just erase all stigma surrounding these topics, because truly, I don't know anybody who hasn't been impacted by these things we've talked about today. So I really would love to just erase all of the stigma and then ask for a million wishes.
Erase the discrimination, the stigma, and really get access to mental health care for all people everywhere. What a world that would be, and that we can hope, we can wish, we can pray that someday we achieve those goals. Emma, it's been incredible having you on the Hindsights podcast. You were a powerhouse of a guest. I knew you would be. For everybody listening, watching, viewing, subscribing, share this podcast with friends, people who are going through brain and mental pain. They need to hear it, and share it with people who are, love those people who are struggling mentally. We need to be stewards of change for people in this kind of brain and mental pain. And that's the goal of the Hindsights podcast. Friends, be well, take care, and whatever you do, be here tomorrow and every single day after that. Thank you very much.